I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. In the course of pursuing the utopian ideal of a world without evil, entire societies have been destroyed. In a new book just published in Canada by Doubleday, John Gray argues that the death of utopia doesn't mean peace, rather a resurgence of ancient myths in openly fundamentalist forms. For example, the promise in Iraq was for democracy to flourish. What's happened instead is anarchy and an emerging theocracy. John Gray joins me from London this morning, where the book's already gotten good notices. He's the author of the critically acclaimed Straw Dogs, Heresies, False Dawns, Al-Qaeda, and What It Means to Be Modern. A former professor of politics at Oxford and a visiting professor at Harvard and Yale, he is currently a professor of European thought at the London School of Economics, as well as a contributor to the New York Review of Books. The book, Black Mass, Apocalyptic Religion and the Death of Utopia, retails for $29.95. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John Gray. Good morning, Professor Gray.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. The title of your book is Black Mass. Where does that come from?
The reason I use the title Black Mass is that one of the definitions or one of the ways of understanding what a black mass was or is among those strange sects that might say and still practice it, it's a Christian mass reversed, put upside down or backwards. That's to say, Satanists and other odd cults and sects invert or turn upside down the elements of central Christian rituals and practices. And one of my key arguments, core arguments in the book Black Mass, is that much of modern politics is a kind of unconscious or unwitting inversion in many cases of central Christian beliefs or myths. And as I say at the start of the book, modern politics, particularly in its most revolutionary passages, is an episode in the history of religion. And so many of the central ideas of modern politics, politics since the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century, ideas of revolution, of utopia, of creating a future for the human species incomparably better than anything it's experienced in the past, these ideas, which are presented in secular form, often in forms which are militantly hostile to traditional Western religion and to Christianity, are, I argue in the book, actually hollowed-out versions or sometimes upside-down versions of central beliefs and myths in Western religion.
And apocalyptic religion means what?
Apocalyptic religion, any type of religion, nowadays when we use the word apocalyptic, we just mean something like an apocalyptic change or an apocalyptic disaster is an apocalyptic viewpoint is one which assumes or posits some sort of large catastrophe. But in its more exact usage, an apocalypse refers to a biblical idea in which at the end of history, mysteries are unveiled. There is often, and this is particularly set out in the book of Revelation, in the Bible, in which at the end of time, at the end of history, there is an unveiling of mystery preceded by or going at the same time as a major battle between good and evil, between the forces of darkness and light, which the forces of good and of light win. So apocalyptic religions, and there is an apocalyptic strand in Christianity, there always has been. I was there right from the start. It goes back beyond Christianity, even to probably the formative religion in this respect was Zoroastrianism. It goes right up to the present in the beliefs of many Christians in many parts of the world, not least the United States. And it's also found as a powerful strand, several strands, in fact, in Islam. An apocalyptic religion is one in which this idea of a final conflict, a conflict at the end of history, followed by an incomparably better world, a conflict between good and evil, followed by a world in which evil's been defeated and only good prevails. That's what an apocalyptic religion is. And the main argument of the book is that that idea, that central conception of apocalyptic religion, sometime around the 18th century was secularized. That is to say, its religious content was removed. And in the Jacobins, the revolutionary club, militant revolutionary club, which was so influential in the French Revolution and which wanted to use and did use terror, methods of terror to achieve its goals, the Jacobins imagined that where in the past it was God who brought about this apocalyptic transformation, humanity could, they could. And that idea was carried over from the Jacobins into subsequent movements, including Lenin's Bolshevik Party and Maoism and others. So I interpret these modern revolutionary movements, which were all officially secular, all officially indeed extremely opposed to religion, and in particular to Christianity, and in China, Maoism was opposed to all the indigenous religions of China and also to Buddhism. But despite this, modern doctrines such as Jacobinism and Leninism, the Bolshevik ideology, I interpret as secular versions of this apocalyptic strand in Western religion.
And we're sort of breaking down the title of your book just to set up the parameters of what we'll discuss. Utopia means what, and why is it dead? Why is it hard to achieve?
Well, the type of utopia is a condition. I mean, nearly all utopias, that's to say, all visions of a society which is either perfect or vastly improved from any society that has ever existed in the past, have within them the idea of harmony. That's to say, a utopian condition for the world, for humanity, will be one in which the major sources of destructive conflict have somehow been removed. Now, Marx and Lenin thought that that required communism, a world without private property and markets and without religion either. Other ideas, other political movements, for example, movements of the right in the last 20 years, have imagined a world in which there would be no major conflict. History would end, as the American thinker Francis Fukuyama put it, with all or most countries in the world embracing what he called democratic capitalism, and once that happened, there would be no major conflicts over what was the right type of government. These are utopias. In other words, utopia is a kind of a dream of harmony, which the conditions of human life don't allow. And the utopias are not necessarily terribly harmful if they're confined to voluntary communities, as they have been in the past. There have been such communities in Canada as well as in Britain and America and European countries. People simply hive off to some part of the country. They live apart or relatively apart, and they attempt to construct a model, an ideal society which lacks the blemishes and conflicts of the wider society. Now, voluntary communities, as I say, are not normally terribly harmful, but they don't last very long. They usually collapse or break down for various reasons. Very few of them last longer than a generation. But when groups such as the Bolsheviks or the Jacobins or the Maoists grab power in a large state or set up a dictatorship in order to promote their vision of harmony, they come up against opposition. And that's when the trouble sets in, because at that point they either abandon the project of communism or whatever project it is, and they're very reluctant normally to do that, or they start repressing the elements in society which don't accept the vision, have a different vision of harmony, or just a completely different vision of human life, or who have religious or other beliefs which are inconsistent with the utopian project, and then you get repression. And in practice, it's my view that utopian politics, as distinct from separate utopian communities, always ends in disasters of this kind. One type of disaster after another, because it comes up against the diversity of human values and goals and needs, and also comes up against the complexities and intractabilities of human history.
And so you seem to think that we will never come to a point as a human race that we would have some sort of uniform idea of utopia that we can shoehorn in any part of the world.
No, the attempt to do that is one can have kind of international conventions and understandings which prohibit or discourage certain particularly terrible forms of behavior. For example, I'm a strong supporter of the international conventions which were set up in the 20th century to prohibit torture. I think they're very good conventions. Unfortunately, they've most recently been rather weakened. But that's not an ideal of harmony. It's not an overarching goal or dream of a perfect or best society. Different societies, different governments, different regimes, different religions, different philosophies can agree to that. What I'm strongly opposed to is the attempt to come up with some overarching ideal which everyone then has to accept, because they won't accept it. And the attempt to impose it, whether within a state, as in the former Soviet Union, or between states or across states, as in modern contemporary neoconservative ideas of regime change, invariably leads to disaster. The historical record is one of almost completely unbroken disaster in this respect. And that will be true in the future as well, I'm sure.
Are you saying that democracy doesn't work, that it is a disaster?
I didn't even mention democracy, but the idea of exporting democracy to conditions where it can be known in advance that it won't work, or that if it starts working, the state will break up and there will be massive sectarian conflict, or to take one of the arguments I make in the book, if one installs democracy in a country where there has been dictatorship, but the type of democracy that emerges is completely different from that which you have had in mind, because of the balance of political forces or the balance of the type of beliefs and values in the underlying population, then promoting democracy needn't necessarily be at all a good thing. After all, what has arisen in Iraq, for example, is not liberal democracy, but a sort of mix of anarchy and popular theocracy, that's to say a type of democracy akin, a more chaotic and undeveloped type of democracy of the sort that exists in Iran. And it's not obviously better than the tyranny that that was overthrown. Indeed, I think a strong case can be made for that if you're a woman, if you belong to a religious minority such as Christians, your position, your situation, your freedom, your well-being is far more threatened than it was under the rather hideous dictatorship that existed before. So the sort of cult of universal democracy is utopian, even though it's utopian in the sense that attempting to realize it in this way very often, not just in Iraq, comes to other gross and obvious case, but also in the Balkans and elsewhere, and of course in Russia, democracy has mutated into something quite different, a type of authoritarianism. It often has exactly the opposite results that are wished or intended or expected. And that's a common characteristic of all utopias. They do produce large results in the world. They have big consequences. Ideas have consequences, and utopian ideas have enormous consequences, but they're normally the opposite. The consequences of what the ideas intended, what those who had the ideas anticipated or desired.
In Iraq, did the experiment or the experience of exporting democracy fail, or was democracy simply not something that would have been good for that part of the world?
Well, I don't think that there's any part of the world that democracy can't work in ever, and I also don't think that there's any part in the world of the world where it's secure forever. I don't think people are divided up into those who can practice democracy and those who can't. It can, but it's crucial to realize that, first of all, there are different types of democracy. Democracy can have very different results. People have tended to forget that there can be something that might be called illiberal democracy, which is a version of which I think now exists in Iraq, and could have been anticipated. Some of the people who opposed the war, as I did, they sort of argued that that would be one of the results, because the underlying, there was no reason to think that the underlying pattern of values of large parts of the people would support the type of liberal democracy that exists in the West, or in Japan, or in Europe, and so forth. So the main it's not the case that some countries can have democracy and others can't. Countries can have democracy and lose it, and others can develop democracy when they haven't had it before. But its consequences and the content of it varies very much depending on the background, the history, the needs, the desires of the people. And quite often, and this is an important point, bringing democracy to areas which have had dictatorship triggers war, and sometimes rather bloody wars, as in the Balkans, and as indeed also in Iraq. I mean, there is no state of Iraq now. It doesn't exist anymore. The Kurds have hived off. They're so far actually the most successful part of that country, the most peaceful and the most with the most development, and the rest of the country is in tractable conflict. And parts of the former Soviet Union have been like that, and parts of the Balkans have been like that with large-scale ethnic cleansing. So even when the result can be something like the liberal form of democracy that most of us think is best, could often be achieved at enormously high cost or not achieved at all.
Professor Gray, do you think that barbarism is rapidly on the rise in our world today?
I do. I do.
What's responsible for that?
Well, there are a variety of factors, as is always the case. I mean, this is not the first time that this is happening. This has happened, I mean, really, I suppose, in the 20th century, the rise of barbarism occurred in its most swift and hideous forms after the First World War. The First World War shattered the balance in Europe. Within Europe, it produced fascism and Nazism, but in the wider world, it also triggered the collapse of empires in Russia, and the Ottoman Empire collapsed. Iraq was at one point, of course. Iraq was constructed as a state from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire. And in the period between 1919 and 1941, shall we say, there was a long period of convulsion and upheaval in Asia and Europe, with very barbarous regimes taking over. Now, nothing on that scale has happened yet, and nothing on the scale of the Great World War, that Second World War that then occurred, it seems at all likely now. But what is the case, which is an interesting development, is that the states that are advancing in power at the moment, as in the 1930s, are authoritarian regimes. The states that are really advancing are China. It continues to advance, and although I strongly believe that the present regime in China is an infinitely better regime than Maoism was. Maoism killed about 70 million people in peacetime, according to the great book Mao, The Unknown Story, by Yung Chan and Professor Halliday, a brilliant book. So the present regime isn't doing that, so it's an awful lot better. But it is a highly authoritarian regime that practices a lot of repression. And it's advancing, and so now again is Russia. Russia, from being apparently semi-ruined at the end of the Cold War, is advancing under the aegis of Putin, who has renationalized natural resources and is using Russia's energy resources to project Russia back onto the international stage. And whereas, on the other hand, the power of the United States, partly because of the Iraq War, which I think has accelerated this really considerably, is fairly rapidly declining. Despite the surge, they've suffered strategic failure in Iraq. That's not surprising. The Soviets did in Afghanistan, the French did in Algeria, the French also did in Vietnam. All of these wars, these types of wars, have been lost. But on top of that, the economic situation of the United States is becoming more vulnerable. It's vulnerable to its oil supplies in the Gulf, more vulnerable than it was before the war in Iraq, and also it's economically highly dependent on China. As I say, in economic terms, there's a high degree of dependency on China for the financing of the federal deficit. And that's a rather alarming situation, that states which are authoritarian and have barbarous aspects are on the rise, and liberal democratic states are on the decline. But of course, barbarism also arises when the various conventions and restraints of civilization are weakened, and to my mind, the conventions and restraints that emerged from the Second World War around issues like torture were part of civilization, and they've got to be defended. If they're relinquished or weakened in kind of ill-considered policies in the so-called war on terror, then that's also a type of barbarism. So I think there are quite noticeable tendencies to barbarism in the world now, and you know, this might seem a somewhat alarmist view, but if you just sit back and consider the way in which the balance of global power is shifting, I think one can see that these tendencies are real.
Do you see the religion's prevalence in Western politics responsible, perhaps, for the decline of the U.S.?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, I think the role of Christian fundamentalism in the Bush administration is obviously only one factor in a series of gigantic strategic errors that they've made. I mean, let us not forget that in respect of Iraq, which is the main one so far, the most grave one so far, that the policy of regime change there, of military invasion, was opposed or resisted, or great doubts were expressed about it by practically every element in American government. The State Department was very cautious. The uniformed military were extremely resistant. If we're to believe what we read in the press, the CIA had serious reservations. In other words, as it were, the collective wisdom of the United States was very cautious, to say the least, about this project, if not even strongly opposed to it. And I believe myself that if, for example, George Bush Sr., before the man had been president, I think there's a good chance it would never have been launched. He was simply too experienced. He'd seen action in the Second World War. He knew the uncertainties and the fog of war. It's a big deal. You never know how it's going to turn out, but you should be very, always look to the downside. That wasn't done in this case. And I think part of it, only one part, of course, because there are many factors, but part of this disaster was a certain type of apocalyptic thinking. One of the interesting things about apocalyptic myths, religious myths, is that the big conflicts that they talk about are very, very violent, very destructive, but very brief. That's to say, the titanic short wars followed by an incomparably better world or an incomparably better situation. I think that's something like what was thought, this sharp shock and awe. 6 weeks, you shatter the Iraqi state. That indeed was done. The armed forces, the official armed forces, the regular armed forces of the Iraqi state were pretty well gotten rid of in short order. That worked. But even before the war, there were those who said, well, we don't know what happens after it. And what in fact has happened after it is an unending, intractable conflict in which the key point is that American power cannot now control the outcome. The surge puts a sort of lockdown on it for a while. The moment that's removed, all these factions and militias that have melted away will reemerge again in full force or even renewed force. So there is, in fact, instead of a sharp, short, titanic, apocalyptic conflict followed by liberal democracy, followed by some almost inconceivable situation of harmony in divided Iraq, what you have is a long, intractable, unending war, which I think we're only at the start of, actually, now, because other countries, even against their will, the most obviously Turkey, for example, at the moment, other countries are being drawn in, reluctantly drawn in, to the black hole that has been created there. So I think you're right. I think the apocalyptic thinking, whether it be explicitly that of religious belief of Armageddonism, Christian Armageddonism, or more secular versions of it, was a factor, rather than the realistic thinking, which says a lot of these wars in the past have been incredibly lengthy and protracted and have ended in disastrous defeat.
So what happens now? I mean,
in Iraq or in general?
In general, how do you see the world turning out? I mean, is the end near? Are you hopeful at all?
Well, there's no end. I mean, I'm an anti-apocalypticist, remember. Apocalyptic thinkers like the early Francis Fukuyama talk about the end of history. In October 1989, I wrote an article which was published in an American conservative magazine shortly after, criticizing Fukuyama's first article, which I think came out in 1989. It was called The End of History. What I said then was, don't be silly, this is not the end of history. It's the resumption of normal history. What's normal history about? It's about ethnic conflicts, national conflicts, conflicts over natural resources, great power rivalries. That's what normal history is. That's national, and that's what we're going back to. That has, in fact, happened. We've resumed normal history with all of its conflicts and with some new players. China wasn't a player 100 years ago. Now it is. India wasn't a player because it was colonized. Now it is. Russia's come back as a player after the collapse. So we're back in normal history. There's no end of any kind. We're just in normal history. The main change is, apart from the fact that there are new players, and this does introduce a new element, is that, and I deal with this in the last chapter of the book, is that environmental shifts, environmental changes, are making these conflicts in some ways more intense. There's no doubt that there is a worldwide competition now between America, China, India, Russia, and other countries for, and Western Europe and Japan, of course, as well, for control of energy resources. I mean, I'm not one of those silly people who think that Iraq was all about oil. There were many other factors, including the sort of apocalyptic thinking we've just discussed. But it was partly about oil, and there's absolutely no doubt, for people who are skeptical about that, that the first Gulf War was about oil. It was 100% about oil. In fact, one of the reasons it was a successful war from the standpoint of those who promoted it is that all the politicians involved, at the time said publicly that it was solely and exclusively about oil. They were honest about it, and they were limited in their objectives, and the objectives were achieved. So there's already been one major war in 1990-91, which was entirely about energy, about oil. And so one of the sort of new factors is that with energy resources, natural resources, water in some countries becoming more scarce, they're certainly finite, even though technology can expand them to some extent, but they are becoming finite, but demand is growing greatly through the industrialization of new parts of the world like China and India. So demand is inexorably going up while resources remain finite, and some of them, like cheap conventional oil, scarce and increasingly scarce. Conflict is ever more about that, and against the background of that, of course, is also ongoing climate change. So that's a sort of a new element, but again, it's not the end. There isn't an end. I mean, there's simply humans who will be confronted with these issues, these problems, these conflicts, and rather than thinking of some revolutionary change in the world, global communism or global capitalism or global democracy, which will conjure them all away, I think what's needed is realist thinking, which says, well, these are pretty intractable, these conflicts, but we can contain them, just as terrorism has been contained in some countries. We can contain it, we can reduce them, we can mitigate them, and that makes them less harmful and less destructive, and that's really our task, not to create a world of harmony like the utopians have talked about or religious apocalyptic thinkers have believed in, have had faith in, but really to cope with the conflicts that go with our world and try and navigate them more skillfully and intelligently.
John Gray, this has been a fascinating chat and a fascinating book, and
I
urge people to pick this up. It's from Doubleday, Black Mass, Apocalyptic Religion and the Death of Utopia by John Gray, 2995. Professor Gray, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much for your excellent questions. I enjoyed our conversation.